Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we celebrate Memorial Day, which was established in the wake of the nation's most divisive war, the Civil War, by looking at our history's second most controversial military involvement, the Vietnam War. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. On May 29, 1932, approximately 15,000 American veterans converged on Washington, D.C., demanding immediate payment of bonuses for wartime services in order to alleviate the economic hardships of the Great Depression. Known as the Bonus Army, this gathering of veterans, many with their wives and children at their side, was an effort to force Congress to pay early and in full the adjusted compensation certificates they earned by fighting in World War I. Congress approved the payment of veterans' bonuses in 1924, but the full payment of those urgently needed benefits was not to be made until 1945. The Army of Veterans moved into abandoned shacks, set up tents and shanties just below the Capitol, and awaited Congress's response. They were disappointed. Congress defeated the proposal for the early payment of bonuses. When a few thousand veterans protested the decision, President Herbert Hoover sent in federal troops, led by Brigadier General Perry Miles and Douglas MacArthur, that drove out the demonstrators with tanks and tear gas. One veteran was shot to death and several policemen and veterans wounded before the agitators were dispersed. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a recent archaeological discovery may render obsolete our previous understanding of how long ago urban civilization began in the Americas. By studying cobbles used in the ancient stone platforms at the site of the ancient city of Carol, 120 miles north of Lima, Peru, archaeologists determined that Carol dates to 2627 BC. Not only has the discovery of the ancient city's true age debunked the myth that early American peoples were only living in small coastal fishing villages in the 3rd millennium BC, but it has also identified Carol as the oldest city in the New World. The 4,600-year-old city was built about the time that the pyramids were being built in Egypt and thrived 800 years before the oldest previously known cities in the Americas. Although the city was originally discovered in 1905, the ancient site's lack of artifacts left archaeologists unable to establish Carol's age until now. Researchers at the Einstein Papers Project have found that Albert Einstein worked wonders with much more than scientific equations. He knew how to dazzle the ladies. A senior editor at Princeton University Press and a researcher on the Einstein Project recently discovered yet another one of Einstein's love letters with a Russian spy. This latest discovery is one in a series of revelations about Albert Einstein's love life. He had several affairs as a young man, one of which produced an illegitimate daughter. At one time, he romanced his divorced second cousin and her daughter simultaneously. This image of the scientific genius throws into disarray the conventional image of Einstein as a frail professor who shuffled around in moth-eaten sweaters, puffing his pipe, seemingly oblivious to the world around him. This is Talking History. As recent revelations by former U.S. Senator and Navy SEAL Bob Kerry remind us, nearly three decades since it ended, the nation still struggles with its memories of the Vietnam War. On Memorial Day, while we honor those who fought in that and all American wars, we also search for the lessons of Vietnam. That is the subject of Terry Clark's conversation with Jim Wilbanks.
Part of the turbulent 1960s, Vietnam was a painful episode in the memory of many Americans. The country has spent much of the last 30 years trying to cope with the lessons that the war taught us. This is no less true for the nation's armed forces. Here to discuss with us the lessons that the U.S. Army took away from the experience is Dr. Jim Wilbanks. He is a professor of Joint Multinational Operations at the Army's Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. However, he is not an official spokesperson of the U.S. Army. He is also the author of a forthcoming book on Vietnamization. Welcome to our show, Professor Wilbanks.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Professor Wilbanks, let me ask you by starting about the complaints that one hears particularly from those that have served in the military or been associated with the military, that the Vietnam War was largely directed by politicians. To what extent is that a fair and accurate comment or observation?
I think that's a fairly accurate assessment. By and large, President Johnson was trying to conduct the Vietnam War and at the same time conduct his war on poverty. Consequently, he was attempting to fight the war in Vietnam and keep it on the back burner as much as possible. And consequently, I think he chose then to direct the war almost personally in many cases rather than to leave it to the generals. And in that particular case, I think the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the senior military leaders, were not there working in their own best interest because they then marginalized themselves in terms of the advice that they provided President Johnson and, of course, the advice that he solicited from them.
Following the war, obviously the military, as did the civilian leadership, engaged in a lot of rethinking about the military's role and I'm sure about the relationship of the military to its civilian masters. What can you tell us about the specific lessons that the Army drew from this reconsideration of its in terms of specific its relations with politicians?
Well, I think this was a very cathartic happening for the U.S. Army, U.S. military at large. Essentially, we saw the destruction and demoralization of an entire institution, and that caused a complete reexamination of the Army as an institution, and that started at the strategic level and went all the way down to the tactical level and included doctrine, training, leadership, and just about every aspect of the military. One of the things that comes out of the Vietnam War is the idea that senior military leadership must take a more active role in providing advice to the civilian command authority. That command authority, by law, is invested in the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense, known as the National Command Authority. One of the things that, by law, the Chiefs of Staff, and specifically the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, are charged to do is to provide an honest appraisal of the use of the military instrument of power in any given situation when so solicited from the National Command Authority. And one of the things that must be done by the senior leaders, and this is a direct result of the experience of Vietnam, I think, is to give an honest appraisal of the risk involved in the use of that military force vis-a-vis whatever the situation may be. And I think there's also recognition that these kinds of situations where we might use the military, whether it be Vietnam, Kosovo, Bosnia, wherever it might be, that the problem may not be inherently, specifically, just a military problem. It may very well involve other aspects like diplomacy, economic measures, and those kinds of things. And I think that's a direct realization of the kind of problems that were presented in Vietnam.
Yeah, as I understand in talking with others and also in the conversation I had with you prior to this interview, there's a deal of sorts that has really worked out between the military and civilian leadership. In essence, the politicians decide when and where the military is to be used. But the military has a substantial degree of autonomy, particularly relating to training, readiness, doctrine. Is this deal new since Vietnam, or is this a deal that's been renegotiated in any way?
Well, I'm not sure I would call it a deal, but there's certainly a certain set of roles defined by law for both the National Command Authority, the civilian masters, and the military themselves. On a specific day-to-day basis, the services, the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, are charged to provide forces that can prosecute the defense of the nation. Within that, those large roles and missions, then the service chiefs are charged to provide trained, equipped, and organized forces that can be used to do just that. Within that large mission, there is a lot of autonomy about how do the services accomplish that in terms of organizing, equipping, recruiting, training, doctrine, all of those kinds of things that go into making up that trained and equipped force. Now, there's a return loop on that for the National Command Authority. Because, say, for instance, in a document like the National Security Strategy, the President will provide guidance to the services telling them what kind of force he needs to prosecute the kind of strategy that he, in fact, wants to conduct as his foreign policy. And also provides certain parameters, restrictions, and limitations, not the least of which is funding. That says, here's the kind of force I need. Here are the resources you have. Now come back and tell me what kind of force that we have in order to accomplish the missions I give you, which is the defense of the nation.
Let's turn back to some of it, more specifically about the lessons learned. I'm interested in what about the media? What have been the relationships between the Army and the media and how they've been changed since Vietnam, or is it because of Vietnam?
Well, I think the military relations with the media was extremely strained, and that's putting it very kindly, I think, by the Vietnam War. I certainly don't subscribe to that idea that some people do, that the media lost the war in Vietnam. I think that's patently ridiculous. However, I do think there is enough blame to go around on both sides, both on as far as the military goes as well as the media in terms of the kinds of things that happened during Vietnam. A perfect example of that is the type of reporting that basically took a military victory like Tet of 68, which it decisively was at the military level, and turned it in basically to a strategic psychological defeat. And a large part of that can be attributed to the kind of reporting on what actually happened during the Tet Offensive. Those kinds of things, I think, are still with us in terms of the relations between the military and the media. I think there's always going to be a tension between the needs of the military in terms of operation security and the needs and desires of the American public to know, as prosecuted by the media. I don't know exactly how that's going to work out in time, but we certainly are still, I think, dealing with the remainder of that experience in Vietnam.
Have there been any institutional efforts to perhaps relate to the media, the military as a whole, relate to the military to the media, say in a more positive manner or in such a manner to get the kind of press coverage they would like to get?
Well, I think there have been a number of things, and a large part of it, and I think this becomes increasingly more important when we have more and more in the media who have less and less knowledge about the military. Now, a perfect example is that prior to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, there was an effort to bring those in the media who would be covering the war to the Pentagon and to give them a thumbnail sketch of the kinds of things that they would see when they, in fact, arrived in the Kuwaiti Theater of Operations in terms of the kinds of doctrine that they would see, what the formations that they would see would actually mean, the kinds of tasks that would be being accomplished, to provide information to them as a frame of reference as opposed to letting them draw their own maybe uninformed conclusions about what they were seeing.
Let me turn to another issue and maybe an issue related to a lesson that maybe the Army learned, the issue of leadership and ethics. What did the Army learn in Vietnam or take away from Vietnam?
Basically, there was a reexamination of the entire military psyche, if you will. There were so many things that happened there that were not good. And unfortunately, the list is long. Rampant careerism, dishonest reporting, all kinds of scandals. The sergeant major of the Army was involved in a scandal that had to do with Vietnam. The My Lai massacre, fraggings by soldiers of their leaders. And there was a direct result of that, a self-examination that said that really there's a number of things that have to be done. One, there has to be a return to discipline. Because by and large, the Army had fragmented by the early 70s, both in Vietnam and in, say, for instance, in Europe as well. Drug abuse was rampant. All kinds of racial troubles. There was a realization that there needed to be an examination of equal opportunity within the military. All of these things can be embodied under the umbrella of leadership, although it's a very complex issue. It covers the gamut from discipline to equal opportunity to ethical treatment, ethical acts by leaders in tense situations, so that things like me lie don't happen.
Following the war, we moved to an all-volunteer force. Has that affected civil-military relations in any significant way?
Oh, I think it has. One of the long suits of the draft traditionally has been in this country that a large part of the American society has had some contact with the military. When we moved away from that and went to an all-volunteer force, increasingly it appears that the military is certainly is becoming isolated from the rest of society. You can take a look at, for instance, the number of people and number of those who serve in Congress who have had military service. The numbers are dropping with every new Congress, to the fact that if you compare now and, say, in the 50s, you would be very stunned at the disparity between the numbers. Consequently, there is the idea, at least in the military side, that the rest of the society, and you include Congress in that, doesn't understand the military, and you can work it on the other side of the equation as well, the rest of society wonders what the military is about.
Returning to just the lessons of Vietnam, how have these lessons, if at all, have they been apparent in subsequent military conflicts that the Army's been called upon to engage in?
Well, I think that you have to fundamentally go a little deeper than that before you get to the recent conflicts. There was a wholesale reassessment after Vietnam by both senior officers and the middle grade officers who are now our senior officers. I'm talking about people like Schwarzkopf, like Colin Powell, like Barry McCaffrey. They began to look at what happened in Vietnam and realize, number one, there was a missing link between what happened on the battlefield and what happened at the strategic level. So there was a renaissance in military thought, a return to the serious study of war. That resulted in a doctrinal revolution. For instance, the establishment of the Training and Doctrine Command, TRADOC, that oversees the training and education for the entire Army, responsible for research, training, doctrine, all placed under a single command. Trying to achieve some sort of unity of effort so that the basic soldier on the ground has an understanding about why they are there. That was not always present in Vietnam when you talk to the basic soldier in Vietnam. A turn toward more effective training, for instance, the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert in California. A leadership and tactical lab, if you will, to try out the new doctrine. And the result of all this over the years was in the early 80s, development of the Airland Battle Doctrine, which was validated by Desert Shield and Desert Storm.
Maybe you could explain just a little bit more for both me and the listeners. What's the Airland Doctrine?
Airland Battle Doctrine was an idea of fighting jointly, specifically between the Army and the Air Force, that looked at the entire battlefield from the rear area to the close fight to the deep battle, and tying it all together in order to achieve a desired military objective. What was thought in Vietnam was that there were lots of military victories at the tactical level, but they really weren't tied toward achieving any meaningful end state. And so rather than having a strategy, we had what one historian has called a strategy of tactics, and really nothing to tie the two together. So it made no difference how many battles you won because it didn't contribute towards the desired end state.
Yes. Let me conclude by asking you, has the Army gotten over the Vietnam War?
I think most, as most of the Vietnam vets have retired, really only our senior officers now were Vietnam veterans. The personal experience, obviously, is very perishable, but I think in terms of an institution, there are some ideas that continue to linger, that we never should go to war half-heartedly, that we should never go to war without public support, that we shouldn't get involved in no-win situations where the military instrument of power cannot achieve the strategic end state. I think these ideas will persist long after those who served in Vietnam have left the service. And so I think the specter of Vietnam will be with us for some time to come.
Professor Wilsangs, I want to thank you for being our guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to Jim Wilsangs, Professor of Joint Multinational Operations at the Army Command and General Staff College.
In this week's interview, we tried to draw some lessons from the American experience in the Vietnam War. One of the difficulties we face in drawing those lessons is basing them on accurate information rather than inaccurate, even romanticized recollections that we form to help us cope with that painful experience. Here to provide another perspective on the war and our recollection of that past event is H. Bruce Franklin, John Cotton Dana Professor of American Studies at Rutgers University. Professor Franklin is the author of Vietnam and Other American Fantasies, published by the University of Massachusetts Press.
What lessons should we learn from the slaughter of women and children by Bob Kerry's raiders? Apologists argue that it just proves that war is hell, or that Vietnam was a, quote, quagmire where we Americans can't really be blamed for our accidents and mistakes. But looked at closely, this episode reveals the true nature of an American war waged against a people and a nation that never did anything to us but ask for our friendship and support. Forget those quibbles about how many people Kerry killed or whether most were first herded together and murdered or hit accidentally by shots fired into the night. Forget that other quibble about whether Kerry held an old man down while one of his men slit his throat or whether it was just his men acting on his orders who slit the throats of the old couple and their three grandchildren. As Kerry has said, quote, standard operating procedure was to dispose of the people we made contact with, kill the people we made contact with, or we have to abort the mission. It doesn't work to bind and gag people because they're going to get away, unquote. The entire region, Kerry explains, was a, quote, free fire zone. That is an area that had been declared enemy territory where every single person living there had been defined by the United States of America as a legitimate military target. This in itself is unambiguously a war crime. The proper name for this policy is genocide. The official history of the war, and one now deeply embedded in popular culture and consciousness, goes like this. The communist nation of North Vietnam attempted to invade the democratic nation of South Vietnam, and America intervened to protect the South Vietnamese people. But the, quote, enemy territory targeted by Kerry's raid was in the Mekong Delta, 75 miles south of Saigon, way down toward the southern tip of Vietnam. There were no North Vietnamese there, just the southerners whose families had lived there longer than the United States existed. We will never learn the real lessons of our war against Vietnam until we recognize its imperial nature. In September of 1945, Ho Chi Minh was reading Vietnam's Declaration of Independence, which began with a quotation from our Declaration of Independence to hundreds of thousands of people in Hanoi. When a small American plane flew overhead, the entire throng responded with a huge cheer. Our military commander, General Philip Gallagher, then sang the Vietnamese national anthem on Hanoi radio. But at this very moment, on September 1945, on the other side of the world, the first of 8 U.S. troop ships was loading an invasion army which we financed and we equipped to attempt to reconquer Vietnam for French colonialism. That is how our war against Vietnam began and why it ended with our slaughter of 2 million Vietnamese people.
You've been listening to H. Bruce Franklin, Professor of American Studies at Rutgers University and the author of Vietnam and Other American Fantasies. This is Talking History.
Something happening here, but it ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I've got to beware.
This memorial is for those who have died and for us to remember them. Thus wrote the designer of the war memorial we recommend to you this week. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. honors and recognizes the men and women who served in one of America's most divisive wars. Located in the National Mall, it contains three components: the Wall of Names, the Three Servicemen Statue and Flagpole, and the Vietnam Women's Memorial. People visit the site for a variety of reasons, some to remember a loved one, others to remind themselves of the cost of war, and for those who know nothing about the Vietnam War, it's a place to learn. The Vietnam Veterans War Memorial is an emotional tour and is a place where everyone, regardless of opinion, can come together and honor those who served.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, we call to your attention a series of programs to air on the History Channel, all on the subject of our interview this week, the Vietnam War. Remembering Vietnam, hosted by Roger Mudd, provides the soldier's view of the key battles and events of the war. On June 4th, Part 1 looks at the year 1965, the year the U.S. entered the war full-time. President Lyndon Johnson insisted that it be a limited war. As a result, there would be no major battles like D-Day, but as this segment shows, there was a series of inconclusive bloody skirmishes. In Part 2, which airs June 5th, Vietnam veterans look at 1967, the year the Vietnamese shifted their strategy from guerrilla warfare in the jungles to more conventional fighting in the cities. In 1968, the North Vietnamese launched the Tet Offensive, a series of deadly attacks that struck at the heart of South Vietnam's urban centers, including the capital, Saigon. In Part 3 of Remembering Vietnam, which airs June 6th, we see President Richard Nixon calling for peace with honor. He begins a slow withdrawal of American troops, turning more of the fighting over to the South Vietnamese at the same time that he orders the invasion of Cambodia. And finally, on June 7th, Vietnam veterans discussed the final American evacuation of Saigon in April 1975 and the aftermath of the American departure. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of the History Channel series, Remembering Vietnam. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Don't walk in.